Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at FreestyleLibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit MyFreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at FreestyleLibre.us.
Celebrated author Felicia Gold, resident of Bedford and member of the Chi Theta Omega chapter of the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated, is thrilled to announce the release of her debut cozy mystery novel, Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, the first in the captivating Bella Hawkins mystery series. Set in the quaint and charming town of Bedford, Texas, this cozy mystery promises readers a blend of suspense, heart, and hope. The novel is now available on Amazon and Kindle and will soon be in some bookstores and retailers. In Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, Bella Hawkins, an autistic English professor with a unique ability to perceive details others miss, relocates to Bedford after a turbulent breakup. As she settles into her new life, she quickly finds herself entangled in the town's deep-rooted mysteries. With her intuitive nature and sharp intellect, Bella must navigate the complexities of new friendships, old wounds, and the dark secrets that threaten the peace of this seemingly idyllic community. The novel's gripping plot unfolds as bodies start piling up, and Bella's determination to solve the mystery leads her to an unconventional friendship with Kumar, a misunderstood local artist. As Bella gets closer to uncovering the truth, she realizes that saving Kumar may come at a high price, unearthing the town's hidden secrets and facing the danger that lurks within. Felicia masterfully weaves a story that explores the themes of resilience, courage, and the enduring human spirit. Through Bella Hawkins, readers will experience the journey of a woman driven by hope, fighting to protect those she cares about while learning to heal her own heart. Felicia Gold is an acclaimed author known for her insightful and engaging storytelling. Her works often delve into the complexities of human relationships and the power of hope. With Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, she introduces a protagonist that readers will root for, admire, and relate to on many levels. Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. Okay, y'all, before we dive in, I want to take a moment to acknowledge that this is my 100th episode. Can you believe it? Y'all have been hanging on with me for 100 episodes of Campus Crime Chronicles, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have such dedicated listeners as all of you. So first, thank you. From the bottom of my heart, I sincerely thank you for your unwavering support of my little podcast that could. I also want to share with you that this episode, this story you're about to hear, was one of the core inspirations that led me to start the podcast in the first place. From day one, I knew I wanted to cover this story and bring attention to this critical topic. But I also knew it would be a challenging one, complex, emotional, and controversial. It would require double, maybe triple the research and an incredible amount of time to piece everything together carefully from start to finish. I wanted to be sure I handled it with the care and accuracy it needs and deserves. I kept thinking, when the time is right, I'll tell Tim Piazza's heartbreaking story, and I'll make sure to do it justice. And then I realized that the 100th episode was the perfect time. So, with that, this episode is rated a 5. In the spring of 2017, Timothy Piazza was like many college sophomores. eager to find his place, to build lasting friendships, and to be a part of something bigger than himself. At just 19 years old, he had his sights set on Beta Theta Pi, one of the most respected fraternities at Pennsylvania State University. To Tim, pledging meant brotherhood, an unbreakable lifelong bond with men who would have his back. But what he couldn't see was the danger lurking beneath the surface. Behind the promises of tradition and unity was a brutal culture of hazing, one that didn't just test loyalty, it pushed young men to the edge of what their bodies and spirits could endure. For some, like Tim, the price would prove far too high. This episode is titled Death by Hazing. So without further ado, let's get started. February 2nd, 2017, Tim Piazza, a sophomore engineering student at Penn State, woke up ready to pledge the rest of his life as a member of the Alpha Upsilon chapter of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity. That evening was bid acceptance night, where a fraternity or sorority formally invites a student to become a member of the organization, and then upon accepting the invitation, or the bid, the prospective member becomes a junior member of the organization called a pledge. Then, after serving a period of time as a pledge, usually for the remainder of the semester, the member then becomes a full member of the fraternity or sorority, called a brother or a sister. For the past 2 weeks, Tim and 13 other young men had been rushing the fraternity. Essentially, when students are looking to join Greek life, they go through a two-week-long rush period, where they visit all of the fraternity houses the first week to learn about all the different aspects of the multiple Greek organizations on campus. Then, to rush during the second week, it requires an invitation or a bid back to a house by the fraternity, usually through a text from a frat brother. Tim had gotten that text earlier in the evening on February 2nd from Daniel Casey, their pledge master, or the brother tasked with guiding the new members through the pledging process. The text directed all 14 pledges to, quote, be outside the kitchen doors behind the house at 9:07. Dress code is shirt, tie, and jacket, end quote. So that evening, dressed to the nines, the 14 Beta pledges anxiously gathered and waited in the bitter winter cold in the back parking lot of the Beta house, which is located at 220 North Burroughs Street in State College, Pennsylvania. At 8:56 p.m., the pledges were led into the Great Hall, where it was dark and all the lights were turned off. Daniel Casey, the pledge master, along with chapter president Brendan Young and another brother, Ryan Burke, stood in the front of the room as the pledges filed in. About 10 minutes later, Ryan Burke led the pledges out of the Great Hall and lined them up. Brothers then instructed the pledges to finish an entire handle of vodka, or 1.75 liters, as they passed the bottle up and down the line until the last drop of liquor had been consumed. This lineup, though, was merely a prelude to the real event that was about to begin, which, of course, involved more drinking. Following the lineup, the pledges were then led up the stairs to prepare them to run the gauntlet, which, according to an article in the Daily Collegian, Penn State's student newspaper, is an alcohol-fueled obstacle course used in Beta's hazing rituals. According to a 2017 grand jury report, the drinking course involved multiple different stations where brothers forced the pledges to stop and consume different types of alcohol in various ways. As the line of pledges waited behind a closed door, they were called one at a time to run the obstacle course. At 9:21 p.m., it was Tim Piazza's turn, and he entered the gauntlet. As he did, Daniel Casey handed him another handle of vodka, from which Tim drank heavily before sprinting to the second stop of the course down the hall. At the second station, Beta brother Nicholas Kubera handed Tim a can of beer to shotgun, as several other brothers stood around, cheering, jeering, and actively encouraging him to chug faster. After shotgunning the beer, Tim then dashed to the top of the stairs leading down to the basement. Before proceeding down, Tim and the other pledges had to each aggressively slap a bag of red wine held by a frat brother before then gulping at least a mouthful of wine and running down the stairs to the final obstacle. Finally, in the basement, a brother manned a beer pong station where Tim and the other pledges attempted to throw a ping pong ball into a solo cup full of beer. If the ball failed to land inside the cup, they had to, once again, chug the beer. After each pledge was done running the gauntlet course, they were all handed yet another can of beer to shotgun before the real party began in the house that night. You see, to celebrate bid acceptance night, the fraternity held a social where beer and wine continued flowing freely throughout the duration of the event, which lasted into the wee hours of the next morning, February 3rd. But the party wasn't the only thing going on inside the Beta Theta Pi house that night. While many of the brothers mingled and drank until they couldn't see or walk straight, Tim Piazza was quite literally fighting for his life. According to the reporting of Sarah Vasile for the Daily Collegian, the Beta pledges emerged from the basement at around 10:30 that night, and all of them were visibly intoxicated, which was later documented from hours of surveillance footage inside the house. According to court documentation, Tim's blood alcohol content spiked that night from a 0 to a 0.36 after running the gauntlet. So you can imagine just how inebriated Tim, as well as the other pledges, must have been. Anyway, minutes later, at 10:40 p.m., Beta Theta Pi brother Lars Kenyon helped Tim to a couch, who was now staggering and hunched over. A few minutes later, another brother, whom I've already mentioned, Nick Kubera, encouraged him to stand up, and then Kubera helped him walk through the dining room and kitchen before ultimately returning to the living room, or I think the Great Hall is what it's called, and back onto the couch. Once again, Tim was visibly intoxicated and could barely even stand up, let alone walk. But then, around 10:45 p.m., Tim did stand up again, this time on his own, and he staggered toward the front door of the Beta house. He tried to open it, but he failed. So then, Tim headed toward the basement steps, passing two other brothers on his way. And shortly after, the specific time unknown, because apparently the cameras in the basement weren't working on this particular night. But y'all, Tim fell down the basement steps, like all the way down them, head first, most likely at around 10:46 p.m. Because at 10:47 p.m., Ryan Burke, Jonah Newman, and two other brothers carried Tim back up the basement stairs, and they placed him back onto the couch in the Great Hall. At this point, Tim was completely limp, and he had a visible bruise on his abdomen. Court documentation notes that the bruise was later determined as the external appearance of a profound laceration to a spleen, ultimately from the fall he had just taken down the stairs. Moments later, one of the brothers attempted to rub Tim's sternum, but Tim was completely unresponsive. A couple minutes later, at 10:49 p.m., the same brother who rubbed his sternum then proceeded to dump some sort of liquid onto Tim's face. But again, Tim did not respond. Immediately after, Burke lifted Tim's arm up, but it fell right back down onto Tim's chest. As in, literally, he was out cold and there was little response left in him. After a few more minutes, at 10:55 p.m., Beta brother Jonah Newman retrieved a backpack, which he then attached to Tim, I guess to kind of like anchor him down, I'm not sure. But just 5 minutes after that, Beta brother Ryan Foster sat at Tim's feet in order to prevent him from rolling over off the couch. Then, at 11:12 p.m., Newman also sat down, but he sat on top of Tim's legs to prevent him from moving at all. A couple minutes later, a newly initiated Beta Theta Pi brother, Cordell Davis, entered the living room and approached Tim. As he leaned over Tim, Davis turned to the other brothers in the room and in a very animated fashion, pointed to his own head and then to Tim's head. Basically, Davis was telling his fellow fraternity brothers that Tim needed medical care and they needed to get him to the hospital ASAP. He went on to scream at his brothers, telling them to get help now. In response, though, Newman shoved Davis into a wall and told him that things were under control, to basically mind his own business. But that didn't stop Davis from speaking up, and he proceeded to find Ed Gilmartin, the chapter's vice president, and tell him his concerns about Tim. According to the Collegian, however, Vice President Gil Martin responded by telling Davis he was crazy and claiming that the other brothers were majoring in kinesiology and biology so they could handle it. Okay. Anyway, about 10 minutes later, at 11:25 p.m., Pledge Master Daniel Casey re-entered the room to check on Tim. And by check on him, I mean he proceeded to slap Tim Piazza in the face 3 times. But Tim didn't respond to that either. After about 30 minutes, at 11:53 p.m., one of the brothers sent a message in their GroupMe text thread, which read, quote, "Also, Tim Piazza might actually be a problem. He fell 15 feet down a flight of steps, hair first, going to need help," end quote. And yes, the text did say hair first, but I'm pretty sure that was like an autocorrect because I'm pretty sure he meant to say head first. Anyway. Now, I'm not sure what happened for the next hour or so, but the next timestamp reported by the Collegian was at 1 a.m. into the next day, February 3rd, 2017. At that point, Tim started vomiting and twitching as he lay on the couch. So Ryan Foster, Joseph Imms, and a third beta brother decided to backpack Tim again in effort to keep him from rolling onto his back if he passed out. 48 minutes later, it was approaching 2 a.m. by this point, Tim rolled off the couch onto the floor, to which 3 of the brothers responded by picking him up and slamming him back onto the couch. As soon as they got him on the couch, Imms struck Tim in his abdomen with very little reflexive response from Tim. For the next hour or so, as the party raged on inside the house, Tim lay on the couch in and out of consciousness. Finally, at 3:22 a.m., Tim attempted to regain his feet and stand up on his own, but he fell backward and struck his head on the hardwood floor. A brother nearby approached him on the floor and shook him for movement, but then that same brother acted unbothered and proceeded to leave the room. After lying on the floor for nearly 30 minutes, Tim tried to stand up again, but he fell right back down, face first, onto the floor. Over an hour later, at 4:59 a.m., Tim stood up and staggered toward the lobby or foyer of the home before falling into an iron railing. After this, he got up again and attempted to go to the front door, but y'all, he ended up falling head first into the front door of the house. 9 minutes passed, and at 5:08 a.m., Tim rested on his knees with his head buried in his hands. It was obvious that he was in major distress as he rolled to his side and clutched his abdomen. At 5:15 a.m., a brother walked downstairs for a drink of water, but as he was making his way toward the kitchen, he simply ignored Tim and stepped over him as he laid there on the floor. About 10 minutes later, another beta brother also came downstairs for some water, but when he noticed Tim, he did attempt to help Tim walk to the Great Hall. But as they were walking, Tim fell down 3 steps, and this brother, too, just left Tim there, and he also stepped over him as he proceeded back up the stairs. Eventually, Tim made his way, somehow, to the Great Hall, where he once again ended up collapsing onto the floor. At around 6:44 a.m., a fellow pledge entered the Great Hall who noticed Tim on the floor, just laying there. But instead of helping him or aiding his fellow pledge member, this dude opened up his Snapchat and started recording, as in he took a video of his supposed brother and posted it to his story. If you can't tell, this infuriates me. But I'm trying to tell the story objectively. Anyway, by 7:18 a.m., Tim attempted to stand up again as he staggered toward the basement steps. During this time, according to a jury report, quote, "Tim's condition had markedly deteriorated, his pallor gray, his body rigid," end quote. And when the jury watched the surveillance video, they said one could easily mistake him for deceased in appearance. In fact, according to court documentation, Beta President Brendan Young would later describe Tim in a text as appearing, quote unquote, "fucking dead." Yeah. Now, I'm not sure what happened in the next couple of hours after this, because according to the Collegian, the next documented timestamp isn't until nearly 3 hours later at 10 a.m. on February 3rd. At this time, 2 Beta Theta Pi brothers began searching for Tim around the house, and eventually they discovered him behind a bar in the basement. The two brothers, shortly joined by a third, then carried Tim up the steps and they placed him right back onto the couch in the great hall. After they laid him back down, they started shaking Tim, but he was unconscious and unresponsive. So they then covered him with a blanket, wiped off his face, and attempted to dress him. Over 30 minutes later, at 10:48 a.m. on February 3rd, 2017, a Beta Theta Pi brother finally dialed 911 and requested medical assistance. Paramedics showed up shortly after the 911 call and rushed Tim to a nearby hospital. But unfortunately, Tim never regained consciousness, and he was pronounced dead at 1:23 a.m. on February 4th, 2017. A grand jury report documents that he suffered from non-survivable brain injuries and, on its own, a life-threatening splenic laceration, draining 80% of his blood into his abdomen. The report specifically noted, quote, "Grand jurors were horrified to observe the unsupervised and irresponsible conduct of Tim's so-called brothers," end quote. In the aftermath of the tragedy of Tim Piazza, multiple Beta Theta Pi fraternity members were held accountable and slapped with a slew of criminal charges, the most serious being aggravated assault and even involuntary manslaughter. But before we dive into those details and discuss how the justice system played out and who exactly was held responsible, I think we need to truly understand how we got here, how something like this could happen, how the systemic culture of drinking and hazing could get so out of control that it literally caused death. Well, to even attempt to understand, I think we need to go back at least 10 years before it happened to 2007.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
According to a 2017 grand jury report, the Penn State chapter of Beta Theta Pi had always been touted by Penn State officials as a model fraternity that held the golden standard of sobriety among fraternities and sororities on campus. But we now know, specifically after Tim's death, that's just not true. At least it hadn't been true for a long time. So let's go back to 2007, when a lot of the excess of binge drinking and cruel, inhumane hazing first came to light. Sometime during that year, two Penn State alumni and brothers of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity, Donald Abbey and Ken Raleigh, set out on a pricey endeavor to renovate specific aspects of the fraternity house at 220 North Borough Street. Raleigh attended Penn State from 1974 to 1977, during which time he met and became friends with Abbey, who was already an alum and had attended Penn State from 1966 to 1970. According to court documentation, Abbey, who went on to become a successful businessman and real estate entrepreneur, employed Raleigh in 2007 to establish a 501c3 nonprofit foundation that would ultimately serve as an endowment to specifically maintain the physical structure of the house. His duties, according to court documentation, included fundraising for the endowment and keeping watch over the house. While Raleigh began that year by establishing the foundation and raising money remotely from Albany, New York, he ended up moving to State College later in the year to directly oversee the home's renovations. You see, court documentation notes, Abbey was a significant donor to both the Penn State football team, which he was also a member of during his time in college, as well as the Alpha Upsilon chapter of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity. So, in 2005, the then president of the fraternity approached Abbey and asked him for a donation to make a few repairs to the 1920s era home. As a prominent donor, Abbey had no qualms about making the donation. However, what began as a $50,000 project to simply correct some water damage soon turned into a multi-million dollar headache because he discovered the whole house needed to be renovated from top to bottom. FYI, the renovations would ultimately take 5 years to complete, from 2005 to 2010, so you can easily see why, just a couple years later, in 2007, Abbey decided to hire Raleigh to develop and manage an endowment that specifically focused on maintenance and repairs of the massive three-story home. Now, during his time in State College, Raleigh recalled that about 50 Beta brothers lived in the house as the renovations took place. And during that time, he said the house functioned more as a nightclub than a fraternity. Raleigh said he soon learned that the young men handled themselves, quote-unquote, very poorly, as he witnessed signs of excessive drinking and vandalism of the home at least 4 nights a week. He recalled that the house was constantly littered with hundreds of beer cans and alcohol containers, which were strewn throughout the house inside and overflowing the property's trash barrels outside. Raleigh would later testify to a grand jury, saying, quote, "They were emptying trash out the windows. They were throwing used condoms out on the front. One time they threw a used condom out on the front entryway about 20 minutes before then university president Graham Spanier arrived with the president of Hershey Medical Center. They routinely would take furniture, television sets, clothing, beer cans, trash, and throw it out the third floor window to enjoy the spectacle of it exploding down the pavement in the back of the house." End quote. Raleigh also testified that the property destruction was always fueled by massive alcohol intoxication. And by massive alcohol intoxication, well, let me just give you some examples. Raleigh recalled one particular night before a football game in 2008, when Beta Brothers stacked at least 100 cases of beer into a pyramid in the backyard, towering several feet high. Another time, he witnessed the brothers running a beer funnel from the second floor stairwell, pouring beer into the mouths of the brothers standing in the lobby below. I mean, does anybody else think this is sounding more and more like a frat movie? It kind of blows my mind, to be honest, because y'all, it gets worse. Trust me. Anyway, not only was Raleigh alarmed about the behavior and actions he witnessed from the brothers, but it all seemingly went on nonstop. It was seriously excessive in his opinion. He said, quote, "Well, it was clear to me that I didn't arrive there and they started drinking heavily. They had been doing it for quite a while, I believe." End quote. And y'all, the situation got so out of hand that Raleigh had to hire professional cleaners to come in and clean the house from top to bottom every football weekend. Literally, a cleaning crew would come every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning during football season. Now, remember, all of this was going on while major renovations were taking place. Like, just to put it into perspective, each floor, one at a time, was undergoing renovations. A crew of workers literally started at the top, restoring the roof, and then worked their way down. When it was all said and done, and the renovations were finally complete in 2010, Abbey had spent $8.5 million of his own money to restore the house to its former architectural glory. According to court documentation, the renovations in total consisted of, quote, "replacing electric and plumbing fixtures, building a new kitchen, installing air conditioning, lowering the granite basement floor to create a larger room, and furnishing the home with an eye toward the original 1928 design of the home," end quote. So, yeah, lots of money. But I'm sure you can imagine just how frustrated the crews working on the home would get when Beta Brothers occupying the house would continually break items that the workers had just built or repaired. For example, they shattered brand new, beautiful stained glass windows after the crew had just installed them. Are you mad yet? Additionally, the Beta Brothers were just plain disgusting, as in they had a pervasive cleanliness concern both inside and outside the house. According to a grand jury report, quote, "workers had to navigate puddles of vomit, urine, and spilled beer," end quote. Y'all, these workers, on the regular, would even find beer cans in the toilets and urinals, sometimes causing the toilets to overflow. In fact, on one particular occasion, the urinal in the second floor bathroom experienced some water problems. When workers attempted to use a plumbing snake to clear the obstruction in the drain, they discovered that sacrete had been poured into the urinal and flushed down the drain. Y'all, sacrete is concrete mix. It's literally a powder that, when mixed with water, forms concrete. I mean, what the fuck? Oh my gosh. Then, on the outside, the lawn and area surrounding the house was constantly filled with beer cans, liquor bottles, water bottles, and just bits of trash and waste, like pizza boxes and Q-tips and paper and food, which was all visible to the public. Apparently, the workers would often have to walk around the outside of the house, gathering all the large trash and debris before they could even begin their workday and safely start working. Additionally, due to the actions and disrespect of the house by the fraternity brothers, the patio doors to the living room had to be completely replaced because members would kick in the doors if they forgot their keys. The grand jury report notes, quote, "The workers ultimately gated around those doors, and measures had to be taken to ensure only the house manager had a key to the gate. Eventually, the workers had to install a swipe card system with a key fob lock on it," end quote. So, again, more money. Naturally, with Abby pouring so much of his own hard-earned dollars into the project, he had a vision and expectation for the house and the Beta Theta Pi brothers living inside it. He testified that he set out to change the culture from one of partying to one of principle. But as the renovations went on and more problems arose that hindered the renovation efforts, Abby became more and more frustrated. Essentially, according to court documentation, quote, "The coat and tie dinner, studious culture of Mr. Abby's time at Beta had been replaced by a broken windows, alcohol-fueled, destructive culture that looked down on honor students and looked up to students of vice and debauchery," end quote. Wow, those are some powerful words. Anyway, perhaps the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, was when Abby purchased some very expensive furniture and soon after, he discovered it had been destroyed. Court documentation notes that the upholstery on the lavish couches he had just bought had been sliced with razor blades. Again, what the fuck, dudes? Oh my gosh. So eventually, after careful discussion and consideration, Abby and the employee he hired to oversee the renovations, Ken Raleigh, agreed that they needed to put a stop to all of the destructive, over-the-top, you-can't-touch-us type of behavior and mentality. It was time to clean house. So after sharing their concerns with the chapter's alumni board, Abby and Raleigh evicted at least 10 fraternity brothers from the house during the 2008 through 2009 school year. However, that extreme action didn't work, and the behavior only persisted. In fact, the active brothers and their families became hostile toward Abby and Raleigh and began complaining to not only Penn State administration, but to the National Fraternity Board as well. Finally, Abby and Raleigh had enough, and they too went to the National Fraternity Governing Board, which was so appalled by the number of alcohol-related incidents during this period that the decision was made to shut down the Alpha Upsilon chapter of Beta Theta Pi and revoke its charter at Penn State in January of 2009. Oh, and just to give you a couple examples of those alcohol-related incidents, well, one time a guest at one of the many parties they threw was beaten unconscious, and another time, a different guest was attacked and assaulted with a beer bottle. Yeah, real classy, bros. Anyway, the Betas didn't lose their charter for very long, because in an overwhelming response to the shutdown, Beta's national leaders approached Abby and pleaded with him to help reopen the house under the men of principle standard that Abby had in mind. And to do so, they agreed to maintain the house as dry or completely alcohol-free, as well as put an official stop to any and all hazing activities. Reluctantly, Abby agreed, but both he and Raleigh were fighting a losing battle. According to court documentation, Abby said their efforts to make the house a dry house were met with extreme resistance at every turn. By 2011, Beta alums were even threatening both Abby and Raleigh about the dry house policy. Among them was a powerful Penn State and Beta alum and a Penn State trustee who aggressively attempted to persuade Abby to drop the dry house policy for good. Court documentation notes, quote, "These individuals even threatened Mr. Abby that his standing among the other alums was dropping and questioned his legacy as he maintained the dry policy at the house," end quote. And Raleigh, well, he received such a harsh and threatening email attacking him about his endeavors to convert the chapter that he filed a lawsuit against the person who wrote it. Gradually, personal business drew Abby's attention away from the fraternity, and according to a grand jury report, quote, "The Beta House devolved to its former ways as a den of partying, alcohol, and destruction," end quote. Now, believe it or not, Beta Theta Pi wasn't the exception among the other fraternities on campus during this time. Oh no, it was the norm. And there were multiple issues with multiple fraternities, which I will share with you in part two of this episode. Also, I'm sure you're thinking, wait, where was Penn State administration during all of this? Well, we just haven't got there yet, because we will also dive into their role, or lack thereof, in part two of this chronicle. And y'all, hang with me, because as I said at the very beginning of this episode, this story is close to my heart, for just because it was one of the inspirations of the whole podcast, but it's also complex and controversial, and it truly needs to be told in its entirety, because Timothy Piazza's death was a terrible, tragic event that likely could have been prevented if only people in power and authority had just cared more. If they had cared more about the much larger issue right under their noses of an embedded culture of stark hazing perpetuated by an excessive obsession with alcohol and drinking and just overall a party culture. So, as I tell this story, please bear with me and give me the time I need to accurately and fully lay the picture out for you. Because I promise, every single detail I share with you is critical to not only Tim's story, but others like him who have lost their lives too due to severe hazing. Which means, y'all, there might even be a part three. I haven't decided yet. It depends on how much information I decide to squeeze into part two. But just a fair warning that this 100th episode of Campus Crime Chronicles will have multiple parts regardless. So definitely tune in next Monday for part two. Okay, y'all, that brings us to the end of part one of Chronicle 100. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Also, to celebrate my 100th episode, I would love for y'all to go leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Those reviews like shake up the algorithm a bit, and they truly help other listeners like you know this podcast is out there. So share it with your friends. Go leave me a review. Okay, well, that's all for today. So bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Campus crony Alexis McDonald is my research assistant. Tune in again next week for part two of this chronicle.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.